Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A quick reminder, you can subscribe to us on any of the usual places, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. And if you like what you hear and leave a positive comment, that helps us a great deal. And of course, you can subscribe and not miss a single episode because we do this every single day. Obviously, there's been a lot of news in the last 24 hours, and most of it has not been very good for President Donald Trump. You have the House Ways and Means Committee asking the IRS for his tax documents, which apparently they can do as a result of a law passed during the Teapot Dome scandal. And then, of course, you have the breaking news in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and NBC suggesting that a lot of folks on the Mueller team have decided that maybe Attorney General Bill Barr is not the reliable narrator that he was told. We were told that he was when he issued that four-page memo that included, what, about 100 words of the actual Mueller report. This broke last night when the New York Times reported that some of the Mueller folks are very, very unhappy and feel that their conclusions were much more negative for the president than were portrayed by Bill Barr and picked up rather uncritically by much of the news media. The Washington Post has followed that up by clarifying that in fact, the Mueller folks had written executive summaries to within that 400-page report, which would have been suitable for release, except that Bill Barr decided that he was going to write his own summary. And then NBC has a fascinating report this afternoon suggesting that one of the reasons that the Bob Mueller did not come to a conclusion on whether or not President Trump had obstructed justice was because there was quite a debate internally within the team that they couldn't come to a consensus about all of that. We don't know how Mueller himself feels about that. And then there is this remarkable paragraph, and again, I'm reading from the NBC story. According to a senior law enforcement official who has spoken to members of Mueller's team, Mueller team members say the report includes detailed accounts of Trump campaign contacts with Russia. While Mueller found no coordination or criminal conspiracy, the official said, some team members say his findings paint a picture of a campaign whose members were manipulated by a sophisticated Russian intelligence operation. Some of that information may be classified, the official said, so it is not clear whether it will be released in a few weeks when Barr makes public a redacted version of the Mueller report. So obviously the plot has thickened rather dramatically, and the same folks who had been dunking and doing the extended victory lap after the Barr memo had come out are now rather dramatically changing their tune. I see that Devin Nunes is suggesting that we pay no attention whatsoever. The president's legal team is pushing back on all of this. But in any case, let's put this in a different context. Steve Kornacki is the legendary number cruncher for NBC News and the author of The Red and the Blue. And he's been on the podcast before. And we're pretty lucky to have Steve Kornacki with us again today. Hey, Steve, good to talk with you.
You too, Charlie. It's an extremely and undeservedly generous introduction, but I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you. You had a piece, and I was actually telling you before we started the podcast that I was reading your piece this morning. I was thinking, boy, this would make a great podcast, that Trump got no bounce from the Mueller Barr report, which the headline was pretty much exoneration, not exoneration, but no collusion, but no criminal charges. But you're pointing out that the fact that this did not move his numbers at all really leaves him with a pretty narrow path back to the Oval Office, because his approval rating, and this has become, I guess, the old normal, that his approval rating just never moves. It's always a flat line. So that the only way that he gets elected is if the Democrats come up with somebody who is as unpopular as Hillary Clinton was in 2016, which by the way, they may do. So let's talk about this. First of all, what numbers are you looking at to determine that the president got no bump at all from this?
Yeah, I mean, so it is to look specifically at Mueller. Obviously, it's a little complicated just by everything you set up there. You know, we had the summary from Barr that came out a couple of Sundays ago. The headlines that were immediately generated said, you know, exoneration on the key question. Obviously, you know, there were folks pointing out that, hey, the language was a lot more muddled when it came to obstruction of justice. We haven't seen the full report, all that stuff. So, you know, there's an argument to be made that this isn't the cleanest test of you know, whether Trump could or couldn't ever get a bounce. But I think it's the closest we're likely to ever get. And for, you know, pretty much a week there, he had the kinds of headlines I think he'd been hoping to get for 2 years on this subject. And you look at the polling that came out. This includes our own NBC News poll that was, you know, that was testing voters during that window of time. No movement. You know, in our poll, you know, we have one that comes out every couple months. His approval rating, it was actually 3 points lower than the last time we had tested. Now, that, you know, it could be statistically meaningless, but you're not seeing any kind of a jump. In other words, same thing in other polls. You look at his average. You know what I always like to do, and, you know, is you look at those. Real Clear Politics does one. There's other sites that do as well. He's averaged together every poll that's out there, and you don't see it in there either. You see him continuing to exist in the same range he's existed in his entire presidency. And in the polling average, you know, that is at his absolute worst. His approval average, you know, has fallen to about, you know, 36% at his absolute best, what you'd call his honeymoon, I guess, you know, a week or two into his presidency. It hit 46, and it's just lived in that zone the entire time, no matter what.
So we're looking at what, about 43% that this Real Clear Politics tracker that after the Barr Mueller thing, it went from 43.1 to 43.2.
Right. A week later. 1 point. Yeah. You know, which is I guess you could call that a bump in some, you know, in some literal sense. But yes, 0.1 point.
What I thought was interesting in your piece, though, is you go through the pattern of the president that and by the way, when his approval rating is flatlined, it doesn't go up, but it also doesn't go down permanently at all. So, you know, you point out that maybe this is just the latest and loudest example of what we've seen over and over again. We have a gigantic news story, you know, followed by all of the pundits saying this is a critical turning point. This is it, followed by pretty much nothing. Can you just go through some of those that where we've seen that pattern in the past?
Yeah. And I just, anybody listening, you know, think back, because I'm sure you remember a lot of these episodes and many more, too. There's been, I think, this sense from people following this presidency from the beginning. There's always been this sense that it's been part of the coverage, I think, that it's, you know, it's on the verge of collapse. Right. You've got all these, you know, things leaking out from inside the administration that suggest instability. You've got Trump himself, you know, walking headfirst into all these, you know, swirling and kind of needless controversies. And what you've seen a number of times is there'll be a major flare up, whatever you want to call it. And his numbers will initially drop. A good example that I use in this piece is the summer of 2017.
Yeah.
Where in the span of a week or two, two major things happened. Number one was the Obamacare replacement effort died in the Senate. That's when John McCain did the thumbs down. Huge, you know, politically embarrassing defeat for Trump. And that was followed very quickly by, you know, the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Trump coming out, making those comments, you know, everybody in the world, it seemed, coming down on him for that. Just politically speaking, toxic. And you did see a drop in his average approval rating. We're talking, though, you know, 2 or 3 points in that period. This is August of 2017. And then,
so we're talking about from about 40% down to about, what, 37.4.
Yeah.
Right. OK.
Yeah.
This is after Charlottesville.
And it was accompanied by, this is the thing, you know, if you think back to the news coverage in that window of time. You know, all of these stories about Trump's support is collapsing. He's lost this group. He's lost that group. You know, anytime he falls a few points in the poll, you can point to the groups that it's particularly pronounced with. You can build narratives around it. And so we just had, you know, Trump in political collapse. How low will it go? You had all of these stories. And what happened was essentially nothing. The world just moved on. 16 other things happened in the next week. Trump tweeted, you know, 400 other things. And by Labor Day, you know, by September 2017, that 2 or 3 point drop was gone. And he was back to, you know, 40-41% in the average. And we have seen that pattern. We saw it in December 2017. We saw it in January 2019 during the government shutdown. We saw it in the fall, the early fall of 2018 after the Michael Cohen guilty plea, after Paul Manafort's first conviction. You've seen these moments where it drops to the low end of that range, and then it bounces back, and it never goes any higher or any lower.
Yeah, and there's so many examples of this. You know, at the end of 2017, when you had all the news, you know, surrounded by, dominated by, the Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore being a pedophile, and Trump going all in for Moore, and again, December 2017, his approval drops 3 points. Usual folks going, okay, this is it. This is the turning point. The election, takes place. Everybody moves on. And those 3 points return. And again, you remember all of these things. That day, the Michael Cohen day, when it was like the perfect storm. Michael Cohen pleads guilty, Paul Manafort's conviction, all of that's going on. A few points, and it just takes a few days for it to come back. Do you have a sense what happens? Who are those 3 points?
Yeah.
Who are the three points who keep going back and forth and going, okay, that's too much. I'm off. I'm off the team. And then 2 weeks, what the hell, I'm back.
And I think they are the key voters, the key people, I think, if you're looking ahead to 2020, to try to understand, because what I think becomes clear just looking at this pattern, first of all, it really is the same pattern we saw with Trump in the 2016 campaign. His poll numbers against Hillary Clinton in the general election is same range. On a bad day, he'd be somewhere in the, 36%, 37%, 38%. On a good day, he'd be 43%, 44%. And it was never outside that range. So we saw it in the campaign. We see it now. And ultimately what happened in the election in 2016 was the folks who came around him in the end, I believe, if you look at the exit polls, I think a lot of them had an extremely negative view of Trump. There are a not insignificant number of people who voted for Trump in 2016 who believed, and they said this in the exit poll, they believed that he did not have the temperament to be president. They had an unfavorable personal view of him, and they didn't believe he was qualified for the job. It was large majorities in the exit poll, large majorities, 60% plus, who were answering yes to these questions. Trump got some of them to vote for him anyway. So it was kind of, I think it was a negative, ultimately they judged Hillary Clinton. They judged what they believed Hillary Clinton represented, the Democratic Party she represented, the, Democratic liberal culture she represented, whatever you want to call it. They judged that a greater threat to them somehow than Trump. And they voted for Trump anyway, despite having just these very intensely negative views of him. And I sense that's kind of continued into his presidency, and it's those same voters. The pattern seems to be when things reach a relative quiet with him. I stress the word relative there, but when things reach a relative quiet with Trump, that's when his numbers tick back up to 42%, 43%, 44%, and you start looking at it and you start saying, "Boy, is there a scenario here where with these numbers he could pull off again what he did in 2016?" And then he does something. It seems. Or something happens, it seems, that reminds that small group of voters, oh, yeah, this is why I don't really like the guy, and the numbers will drop.
But this is an important point, because it was, and of course I lived through all of this, watching voters make that binary choice, and people need to remember in 2016 how bad Donald Trump's numbers were, his disapproval rating, mm-hmm. the number of Americans that thought that he was dishonest. And you look at those numbers in any sort of real context, and you would have to come to the conclusion there's no way that Donald Trump can be elected unless, of course, he runs against somebody whose numbers are even worse, which he actually had the benefit of doing. But this negative partisanship, I don't think can be underplayed, that people can look at Donald Trump, have no illusions about Donald Trump, and yet decide to vote for him if, in fact, they perceive the other person to be that much more loathsome. And this binary choice is so baked into, and I know it's almost become now a cliche to talk about our tribal politics, but these numbers certainly reflect this. I mean, really, when it comes down to, as you point out, most Americans are set in their opinion of Trump, and they're not going to change their minds no matter what happens. Nothing. I mean, I think that's been established at this point, that there's not, whatever we find out about his taxes, it's not going to make a difference. Whatever we find out in the Mueller report about obstruction of justice, it's really not going to make a difference, is it?
That would be my guess at this point. Yeah. Because the other thing is, and I say it's a continuation of a pattern. So, okay, the initial coverage of the Mueller report was good for Trump, and you saw no bounce. The flip side of that is, think back over the last 2 years or so, how many moments we've gotten some bit of information about the Mueller investigation or something, you know, tangentially related to it, you know, something with Michael Cohen testifying in front of Congress, you know, that sort of thing. These moments that looked like these are damning turning point moments for Trump. And they also either they didn't correlate with any drop in the polls for him. That was often the case with these supposedly, you know, world changing Russia revelations. Or, as I said, they correlated with these very slight, very brief drops and then a quick return to kind of that baseline. So, yeah, I mean, I think each end of this, I feel, has kind of been tested now. Feel it was kind of tested in 2016. The most famous example in 2016 campaign, I think, clearly would have been the Access Hollywood tape, where mm-hmm. we actually saw a very, you know, similar pattern. And I guess this is just sort of a you know, my gut talking theory. But I mean, the way I kind of look at it is there may be something about Trump and about this sort of all consuming political cultural warfare that he's sort of set off around him, that it raises the stakes to people on both sides. And so Trump versus his enemies, however you want to define that, it becomes much bigger than an individual battle, an individual story. And on either side, when they look at it, well, I can't say I support Trump now because that's giving in to them. Or on the other side, I can't right. turn on Trump even though I don't like him because it's giving in to them. I just think in a lot of people's minds, one of the consequences of just the volume of our politics, the intensity and the personalization, all these things, I think it just raises the stakes in people's minds more than it's been before.
Yeah, and as you point out, it is important to just remind people that, you know, Donald Trump is not a popular president. There's no indication that he's ever going to become a popular president. Historically, his numbers are really almost unprecedented in terms of his inability to crack. I mean, you've had other presidents who at some point in their presidency have hit 60% approval ratings, particularly with a good economy.
Jimmy Carter did. Bill Clinton, yeah. You know, in their first term. Right. And, you know, Bill Clinton had a really rocky first term, you know, but by the end of it, when he was coasting against Bob Dole, yeah, he hit 60%. He certainly hit 50%, you know, early on in his term. Trump, you know, as I said, Trump got to 46 1 week, you know, 2 weeks, I think, into his presidency. 46%, and that was the peak. So again, yeah, I just think it's a different model. I think that's the thing we have to get our heads around. It's a different model than we've seen with past presidents. I think we're used to looking at numbers like Trump has and saying, totally, you know, you can't get reelected with numbers like this. The problem with that analysis is he got elected with numbers like that in the first place. And so the question is, can you get reelected by the, you know, the same model? And I think that's where you were saying, I think the key variable in all of this, and this is my question, who becomes the Democratic nominee and what does that Democratic nominee look like after, you know, 6 months of just direct political combat with Trump? Because Hillary Clinton's, you know, her unfavorable score on Election Day in 2016 was 54%. And I think that's what enabled Trump to get by. If you look back in 2012, you know, Election Day 2012, Barack Obama got reelected. His personal unfavorable, I think it was 46 that day. So, you know, give me a Democrat. If you get a Democrat up there that's got Obama numbers in 2020 against Trump, you know, I think that Democrat probably wins. But if every Democrat's going to end up where Clinton ended up in 2016, you know, I think Trump's got a chance, I think, with approval numbers like this.
See, this is a really interesting point, and it's an indication of how ugly 2020 is going to be. I mean, I think we kind of already know this, but if the only way that Donald Trump can be reelected is by toxifying his opponent, we know what kind of a campaign that's going to be. And, you know, this point you're making, you know, is there any possibility that a Democrat can go through all of these primaries and a general election fight and have the kind of favorability that Barack Obama had in 2016? And your last line is, or does the tribalized political and media culture of the Trump era ensure that anyone who steps into the arena with him will end up in the same shape as Clinton? And that's an interesting question. And I was thinking about that today. Which of the candidates would be able to survive the kind of, you know, tsunami of negativism that's headed their way? And I'm not sure that I can be confident, because in the modern era, you can demonize just about everybody. I mean, okay, say Mayor Pete right now is having his moment, but there's actually, I'm not trying to pick a fight here, but there's actually a post on social media by a prominent conservative suggesting that, well, Mayor Pete is okay with bestiality, okay. And I sort of sat back and went, okay, so, you know, Mayor Pete may be having his moment, but we are living in such a radioactive, such a vicious political environment. I don't know that anyone's popularity is going to be able to survive that. No one's Teflon.
I have the same, you know, I have the same question. I have a thought that I keep returning to, just thinking back to 2016. And if you remember, at the outset of that campaign, I'll say, you know, early 2015, when the fields are getting set, remember that Hillary Clinton got in the race on the Democratic side. There'd been that whole movement called Ready for Hillary, and about every Democrat minus Sanders and O'Malley and a couple others decided not to challenge her. The reason for her perceived strength among Democrats was perceived electability. It's totally forgotten now, but when she stepped down as Secretary of State in 2013, she was at the high point of her career, favorable numbers of 65% to 70%. And there was this logic among Democrats of, you know, wow, she's like totally elevated herself, most electable candidate. Why would we ever chance it with anybody else? It's one of the reasons Biden didn't run. There was such an energy to get behind Hillary Clinton. And Biden's numbers at that same time as vice president, I think this is also forgotten now, were not good. You know, he had numbers in late 2015 where he is more unpopular than popular. And so there was a sense among Democrats that Clinton was the winner and Biden would be the risky bet. And you play it out. OK, now put Hillary Clinton back in the political arena. Well, you saw what happened there. Now leave Joe Biden out of the political arena day to day, and he starts to look better and better and better, you know, until you come to this point where Democrats look at him now and they say, oh, if only Joe Biden had run in 2016, we would, you know, but that's what happens, I think. And so so look at Biden now. Those numbers, you know, those numbers with all voters look very strong. Put him in the arena like Clinton was. You know, there's a lot there. If you're a Republican, a Trump supporter, you want to go after it, there's a lot you can make some hay with, I think.
You know, a point that I have made both on MSNBC and on this podcast is also, you look at the Democratic Party, what it did in 2018, and the way they flipped so many of these, you know, purplish districts with candidates who ran. You know, they were progressive, but they were also, you know, pragmatic. They were center left candidates. You had Connor Lamb, you had Abigail Spanberger. It really strikes me, and you obviously followed that congressional map very, very closely. The Democrats did not pick up 40 seats in 2018 in that blue wave by running candidates like AOC in those districts, did they? In a lot of ways, the messaging of the Democratic Party has been diametrically opposed to the messaging that won the House of Representatives in 2018. Is that a fair read?
I think that's right. And I think the other ingredient that was there in 2018 that may not be is there was a national message, whether it was spoken or it was implicit. There was a national message there. That I think helped all of these Democratic candidates who won. And that was, don't you at least want a check on Donald Trump?
Right.
You know, he's the president. Okay. You got these Republicans in the House. You got these Republicans in the Senate. Let's put a check on this guy. And I think I think it's one of the reasons why you see the opposition party so often do so well in these midterm elections, because I think even if it's not spoken, I think that's in people's minds. You're not giving away everything to the party you're voting for. You're just putting a check on the other one. And people do seem to, on some level, like that divided government. In 2020, you know, Trump will have the ability, I think, potentially to stand up there and make a very similar argument. Like, hey, you got the – okay, you put these Democrats in charge a couple years ago. You see a little bit about who they are. AOC will obviously be somebody they mention all the time. They already are. You want to give them everything? Or do you want me here to stop them?
Right.
It becomes there's almost, you know, it's a tug of war at that point.
No. And you could see that. I mean, I can see that among conservative voters with the sense that, well, look, the Democrats they're going to push socialized medicine. They're going to push the Green New Deal. They're going to push, abortion on demand up until the moment of birth. The only thing standing between you and this socialist hellscape would be Donald Trump. And also, the presidential election is not a referendum. Do you like Trump or do you not like Trump? It's a choice. It's like, you may not like Trump, but are you going to vote for Bernie Sanders? And so that also changes the dynamic rather dramatically, which, again, is kind of the point of your column, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's just look at the history on it. I mean, you know, well, but let's go back to, 1982. Reagan had a brutal midterm. Right. And, hold the presidential election that day. He probably loses. World is totally different in 84. Clinton had the Republican Revolution in 94, written off as politically dead. Ends up winning in 96, running against essentially that same political revolution that had nearly killed him 2 years earlier. Obama, 2010, brutal midterm, right? 63-seat gain for the Republicans, runs against that, sort of Tea Party Republican Party in 2012, and it gets him reelected. So, I mean, we've seen this, really three times in the modern era, and the setup is there. And that same setup's there for Trump, brutal midterm. Now you're starting to see what that national message is going to look like in terms of, okay, folks, this is your choice. This is the Democratic Party that I'm running against. That's, it's worked three times in the past. I know things are different now, but I leave it as a very open possibility that it works for a fourth time.
The Democrats will say that they are very much focused on electability rather than ideological purity. But do you have any sense who the front runner is right now? I mean, other than the conventional wisdom that it's Bernie and Biden, do you see anybody out there that you think is going to surge to the head of the pack and would be electable?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I guess my answer, I give you the conventional wisdom answer, but I may be more just speaking analytically, day at the races, I'm trying to pick the winner in the race, right?
Yeah.
I may be more bullish on the prospects of Sanders winning the Democratic nomination than others are.
Really?
Interesting. Yeah. I'll tell you why I say that. My sense is, there is a sense, I should say, that there's a ceiling on his support among Democrats. I think that's shaped, obviously, by some of what we saw in the 2016 primaries. He, especially with black voters, he got wrecked in 2016 and just could never get, attain critical mass there. Some of that's informed by just, I think, the conversations that take place online and a lot of the media's understanding of these things, I think, comes through there. But what's really notable to me is when you look at the polls right now of Democratic voters, if you took the names away and it's just a blind test of the numbers, you would not look at Bernie Sanders' numbers and say, wow, that guy's got a ceiling. You would not look at those numbers and say, this one looks different than the others. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. And I think he may be much more broadly acceptable to voters in the Democratic Party than we realize. And when you factor in, then this thing starts in Iowa, goes next door, his next door state, New Hampshire. If he can get on a roll early and you don't have, Hillary Clinton and the big sort of built in base of support that she had, I think there may be more voters who are willing to come over and kind of coalesce behind. Not totally different than what we saw, frankly, with Trump in 2016 on the Republican side.
Oh, I see the parallel, and also the fact that it's such a huge, wide open field gives an advantage to somebody who has this kind of the name recognition, the built in structure, $18 million. In the bank right now. It's completely plausible, because I do have that sense. You look at Bernie Sanders and you go, okay, he's this sort of crazy old guy, who's a little eccentric. There's no way that they're going to nominate him. But I kind of remember being there 4 years ago, mm-hmm. watching the Republicans do the same thing. Steve Kornacki, thanks so much. The piece is Trump got no bounce from Mueller. That leaves him a narrow path back to the Oval Office. It's on the NBC News website. Thanks so much for joining me again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Charlie. I love doing this.
Appreciate it. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.